Welcome to the 173rd episode of Reverse Sweat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chat.
It's 85 years since the beginning of the timeless test in Durban between South Africa and England. That test lasted 11 days and there was no results. On Reverse Sweat Radio, we promise you a much more conclusive finish today.
And actually, this episode, we have we've got a few test series, iconic test series that we are going to be discussing. We're going to be talking about the Tide Test of 1960. We're going to be reviewing a book about the Australia-India series in 2020-2021. Before that, though, Andy, you have been keeping your eye... you reliably keep your eye on such matters as the Logan Cup. Answers on a postcard if anyone has ever heard of the Logan Cup. I certainly haven't.
Now, I'm going to start this podcast with a question, which is who took the most wickets in this winter's Logan Cup, which is, of course, Zimbabwe's four-day domestic competition. Now, unlike you, Toby, I know this will be an easy one for our knowledgeable listeners. The answer is, of course, Alex Russell, a 21-year-old leg spinner who plays for Northants, and he's taken 37 wickets at 30 apiece for the Mashonaland Eagles. Interestingly, former England spinner Dom Bess has also been out in Zimbabwe this winter. And I found this story cheering in lots of different ways. It's always great to hear about the success of a young English leg spinner. You know, we don't go down the next worn route too quickly, but it's fun nonetheless. Long-time listeners will also know that I have a lot of affection for Zimbabwe. I spent some years there as a child, loved the country. And I know it's still sadly a very troubled place with an awful lot of challenges. But I listened to a short clip of Russell talking about his experience there, and he had clearly loved it and had the most wonderful time. And I found that very, very cheering to hear. And perhaps finally, I just enjoyed the unexpectedness of seeing an English leg spinner on the top of the Zimbabwean first-class rankings. I saw this by accident, really, in that it was some county news linked to Northants. And I would never knock players who are doing the worldwide T20 circuit. I'm sure it's a lot of fun, and I'm sure, obviously, everyone has the right to kind of earn the money they can earn. But this is an altogether more adventurous experience, and I imagine when Alex Russell, you know, looks back on his career, this will be one of those experiences that he treasures.
Now, I assume that when you wake up in the morning, woken by your delightful daughter, the first thing you don't do together is to look up the overnight Logan Cup scores, or not even overnight when you're in the UK, same time zone. This is probably why you follow the Logan Cup. But do you have a sense? I mean, you mentioned Alex Russell, you mentioned Dom Bess. Is there a kind of ready exchange of English players and indeed international non-Zimbabwean players into the Logan Cup more generally, do you know? Is it seen as one of those places where you can go and play cricket in the off-season, or is it very much by exception?
So there aren't many out there. Interestingly, the Alex Russell transfer apparently came about because Elton Chigumbura, who was a bit of a Zimbabwean all-round hero back in the day, he had played at Northants back, I think, in the early 2010s, and that was a link, really, and he sort of got in touch with Northants and they made it happen. I would guess, and this is me slightly guessing here, you know, I can't imagine there's tons of money knocking around. So I think sort of paying overseas players is not straightforward. And I imagine the Zimbabwean League would have the other challenge, like, I guess, like the County Championship or others, that you're always trying to juggle that balance, aren't you, between opportunities for homegrown players and overseas players. But yeah, very fun to see the pair of them out there. And I think it says something about, you know, personal initiative as well, doesn't it? You sort of say, I mean, Dom Bess as well is an interesting example, someone who was in the England team, now I guess is finding himself quite a long way back in the queue as far as England spinners go. And it does seem to show quite a lot of initiative to say, I'm going to go and play some serious four-day cricket in an environment that, you know, it's a stunning, stunning country, but it's not a straightforward country. So I think it reflects well on both of them.
And just going back to what you were saying a second ago in terms of the Zimbabwe wanting to make sure they give opportunities to their homegrown talent, at the same time it must be a benefit for them to have a sense of internationalism to this competition and people coming in from overseas to to play as well. So hopefully there are sort of benefits on both sides.
Definitely. And I was very heartened. I must shamefully admit I was not following the Logan Cup closely, but I was very heartened to see that the tournament is in health of some sort. You know, it's a proper four-day tournament. And, you know, as we know from the English experience, that is not something to take for granted. So it's great for Zimbabwe cricket that it is in good health. And I will be watching Alex Russell very closely this season. Now, away from one top-class competition to another, what have Dr. Carles Hooper been up to this week?
So Dr. Carles Hooper's my Sunday side here in Sydney, very informal Sunday side. The name, as a brief aside, since you didn't ask, was derived from the fact that the team used to be the ABC, the BBC equivalent team, paid for by the Australian Broadcasting Corporation as a kind of, collegial get-together of staff. Every year we had to write off to the senior management to request the funding of the match fees. There's an iconic ABC broadcaster called Dr. Carl, and at the same time, when the team morphed from being an ABC team to just a friendly side, our captain, his greatest hero was Carl Hooper, so hence the name of the team being Dr. Carles Hoopers. Anyway, we, as I've reflected a few times on this podcast, we don't always cover ourselves in glory, and today was no exception. We were roundly thrashed, our last game of the league, actually, for this summer. We made 100 odd off our 20 overs. It was never going to be enough. It was knocked over in about 12 overs with 5 or 6 wickets in hand. But there were a couple of moments in the game, despite the run of play being very much against us, that gave me, I suppose, sort of food for thought. The first was an over from a ropey right-hand bowler, I think trying to bowl off-spin, but it was difficult to tell what they were trying to bowl. Went for 6-6-6, and then a cut shot in front of square hit flat out to the boundary, where the fielder, kind of leaping to their left, took off one of the most extraordinary catches I think I've ever seen in this format of the game, only to discover upon taking the catch that they were sort of 5 or 6 yards over the boundary by this point, so another six. And then there was a moment a couple of overs later where, in fact, the bowler in question, fielding at long on, sent in a throw from the boundary which was flat and hard. I think he was kind of spurred on by his bowling, having been hit for about 28 runs off the over. Threw in this return, which was just a delight to see in terms of one bounce 2 inches above the bails. You know, when you go and see international cricket and you think, how do they throw it that flat from the boundary? I could throw it half the distance and a quarter of the accuracy. And in that instance, with this bit of fielding, the batsman was home, and so the kind of throw didn't really mean anything. But both of these things kind of made me reflect on the beauty of cricket, that a moment of brilliance is a moment of brilliance, whatever the result. And sometimes the result of it, a beautiful cover drive is a beautiful cover drive, if it goes to the fielder or not. The cover drive in and of itself, of course, it's kind of more brilliant if it finds the gap in the if it finds the gap in the field. And I don't want to sound like sound too much like Pollyanna, but I was reflecting as I was standing in the field that there is a huge amount of satisfaction to be derived from these moments, sort of regardless of their outcome, these individual moments that happen in any game of cricket.
When you look back on games, and I sort of mean this both immediately in the couple of days after, but also months, even years after, I always find you remember it in moments. That great innings that you play, or that terrible innings that you play, it boils down to, and I still remember, that shot, or as you said, that bit of fielding, they still come back to me. And that's why I think, exactly as you say, these long afternoons, these long days, they often do boil down to a couple of wonderful moments. And sometimes, I think what's very heartening about your description there is, you could have written that off as a bad day, couldn't you? But somehow, yes, a few wonderful moments rather salvage it. Now, given your... Well, actually, I don't know if this is an exclusive for our listeners, but given that you will be returning to this sceptred isle, what are Dr. Carles Hooper's going to do without you?
I think they're going to get on just fine without my kind of medium pace wrong-ins and inability to open the batting without soaking up too many balls for too few runs. But I think the greater tragedy is going to be the fact that reverse swept radio's one point of difference, which is our interhemispherical setup, is gonna be blown out of the water. So that's something we're really gonna have to look at and do something about.
I am going to miss having the Toby Chad Sydney Andy Ryan London on our Twitter page, because that I thought that always looked nice. But presumably this is also going to set off a bidding race in the English Village Club circuit. You know, Toby Chad is on the market.
It absolutely is. And just to your earlier point, I was rather hoping that the reverse swept radio coffers, our extensive bank accounts from the royalties from the podcast, would enable me to fly back to Australia every 3 weeks to record the podcast.
From the archives, and in this episode, Toby is going to take us back to 1960 and the Tide Test, when the West Indies and Australia could not be separated.
It seems a bit remiss to me that after 173 episodes of Reverse Swept Radio, we're yet to focus on what is perhaps, or what is considered, one of the most thrilling games of all time, and certainly one that's gone down in history as the most iconic. The Windies Tour of Australia in 1960 was set up to be a real cracker from the start. For the West Indies, Frank Worrell was nearly anointed as Test captain. He was the first black captain of the country's Test team after a concerted campaign led by CLR James and others. Before people write in, yes, George Headley did captain for a single Test in the 1940s, but just as a stand-in. Worrell and Richie Beno, who was the Australian captain, both shared a strong desire to play attacking cricket as much as anything to kind of combat the dourness that was being brought into the game by Len Hutton's England at the same time. So from the very beginning, the series felt historic because of Worrell being the first black captain of the West Indies, and it also felt like it was going to be full of exciting cricket. The teams also were really well matched, and they got on. There's a lovely story about the night before the first test where the members of both teams just hung out in a hotel room and played calypso records to one another, which you can't necessarily imagine in this day and age. It was the first test of the series, which was this legendary Tide Test. It was played at the Gabba in Brisbane. I'm just going to rattle through the test before we get to the very ending of it, because really it's the ending that's the most interesting bit. The Windies win the toss. They elect a bat, no doubt thinking ahead to batting fourth on an uncovered pitch and wanting to give Australia that particular chance. The Windies make 453 in 108 ball overs. They're 8 ball overs, crucially, as we'll hear towards the end of the game. So Windies make 453. Australia make 500 in reply. The wonderful Norm O'Neill, who deserves a from the archives in his own right, nearly hits a double century. He has been brought up as being the next Bradman, this is actually his highest ever Test score, and he goes from there to fade into obscurity. The Windies fail to fire with the bat second time round. They leave Australia with a target of 233 to get. Richie Beno tells the story of going onto the ground as that chase starts, as the Australians start their chase, and seeing a whole lot of clover flowers on the outfield. And he realizes that the grass hasn't been cut, and it has rained on the morning of Australia starting their last innings. The groundsman couldn't get his mower out because of the rain, and so there isn't going to be a fast outfield to help the Australian chase. And so what they were actually initially quite confident about, Beno talks about being very confident of chasing 233, suddenly the complexion of that chase changes a bit.
I found this really interesting, because we so often talk about home teams trying to use the ground to their advantage, and I thought in that situation maybe it's a sort of slam dunk thing that you really just cannot, it was just beyond the mowers in that situation, but it just astonished me that with that sort of chase in a game of that sort of importance, what the Australian team wanted slash needed, or maybe perhaps I'm wrong and that we were dealing with groundsmen who were a bit more independent.
It's interesting because when you read Beno's account of this, he makes this comment about the only thing I could have done was to be get the mirror out myself and do it myself. And reading it, you do kind of think, is he making a bit of a snide comment here about the fact that it was quite doable and he just had reluctant ground staff there? Because surely if it's dry enough to play, then it's probably dry enough to mow. But at the same time, they probably had, I don't know, what was the average width of a mower in 1960? That's a trivia question for you, because it might actually have taken quite a long time to do it, and therefore they might not have had time to do it before the start of play. Who knows?
It's a good cricketing what if.
Perhaps it really is. It's a very important moment.
We would never be, you know, talking about it with any interest today. So
exactly, and this last innings is absolutely full of what ifs. So there's the slow outfield. The other impediment that the Australians have is Wes Hall. Now, Wes Hall has anyone squeamish listen the way now. Wes Hall has his own challenge of his own, which is that his feet are heavily, heavily blistered. And he decides to treat this by slicing off all of the blisters off the back of his feet and basically leaving the bottom of his feet just raw flesh. Andy has his head in his hands looking slightly green. And he puts this long piece of... He basically creates a sole for his own foot by putting a long piece of sticking plaster across the raw flesh on the bottom of his feet. I mean, imagine how painful that was to pull off at the end of the day. So he does this, and he doesn't just hobble in and bowl a couple of overs. He bowls 30 overs, 38 ball overs in this final innings, and he reduces Australia to 92 for six. And so surely chasing 230-odd, the game is over. And that is until Alan McGillivray decides as the commentator to head off and get an early train. He decides the game is over and he doesn't need to stay and watch it. Again, in terms of what ifs, if Alan McGillivray hadn't left the ground at that point, maybe the cricketing gods hadn't wanted to spite him by creating such an exciting result. At that point, Davidson and Richie Beno fight a remarkable rearguard action. They put on 134 for the seventh wicket before Davidson is run out. So now it sort of feels curious for someone to be run out in these circumstances. That's quite a kind of grave sin. But the context is that they've been taking every single that they could, which had actually resulted in the West Indian fielders getting a bit frustrated and a few overthrows happening. So the plan sort of got ahead of the batsman when Beno called Davidson through for a single to Joe Solomon, hoping to get off strike, and Solomon throws down the wickets from mid-wicket. Looking back on it, Joe Solomon, it's quite fun that he talks about the fact that he immediately talks about throwing stones at mangoes to get them down from trees, and that was what was responsible for his the accuracy of his fielding at this point. So there's panic in the Australian dressing room. Wally Grout, who's in at number nine, he's the last acknowledged... I mean, he's not an acknowledged batsman, but the last acknowledged bowler who can bat. He's been chain-smoking to calm his nerves. He stuffs his gloves into the top of his pads. He forgets that they're there. He gets up to go in and suddenly thinks, where are my gloves? Gets in a massive flap about it, running around the changing room trying to find his gloves. Just pandemonium everywhere. Australia at this point needs six off one 8-ball over, and they have three wickets in hand, and Wes Hall, with his blistered, plastered feet, is bowling. Grout is on strike. So, first ball, in the traditions of cricket commentary, we should do that thing, you know, where you knock a pencil against a glass or something to make the sound of a ball hitting the bat. First ball hits Grout flush in the midriff. He doubles up in pain, but Beno's not having any of this, you know, kind of wimpish pain stuff. He insists on calling him through for a single off the
How
first
are you
ball.
Going to simulate what's the sound of a ball hitting the midriff? That's a sort of...
I don't know, maybe I just punch myself in the chest. Is that
punch yourself repeatedly in the chest.
Ball two, Beno on strike. Wes Hall bowls a bouncer to Beno. It's quick, it's well directed. Beno takes it on. He thinks, here's an opportunity. If I get anything on it, it's going to go away to the boundary because this is so quick. but all he gets is a little flick on it and goes through to the keeper. Now, there's a fun little sub-story here, which is Frank Worrell, before this over, had said to Wes Hall, do not, whatever else you do, bowl a bouncer, because if there's an edge, it goes for four, it's all the pressure's back on us suddenly. So after Benno's out and all the fielders converge, Frank Worrell goes up to Wes Hall, and Wes Hall is expecting him to look a bit sheepish and say, oh, good ball, well done, you know, right ball in the circumstances. Apparently Wall was furious with him and didn't even congratulate him on the wicket, just said, don't do that again, you're being utterly stupid, you're gonna lose us this game if you do that, if you do that again. So Mekif is the next man in. There's a dot ball. The next ball they decide they have to run, so they take a bye through to the keeper, who tries to throw down the stumps and misses. So it's four to win now from four balls. If it feels like this over's gone on a long time, it's obviously because of the eight ball over. Four to win from four balls. The next ball, Grout flicks a catch out to square leg. Rohan Kanai, who's fielding at square leg, and Wes Hall both go for it. It's an absolute complete dolly, absolute dolly. They both go for it. They collide. Wes Hall takes his eye off the ball, drops it. Run taken, no wicket. Next ball is a pull shot into the leg side. On any other ground, it would be a certain four. But remember here the long grass. So Conrad Hunt is able to get it. He finds his way to the boundary. He picks up the ball in the long grass, and he produces what is one of the greatest pieces of fielding. It's a hard, flat throw from the boundary straight to the keeper, and it runs out to the batsman as they try to run for three. So at this point, they try to run for three, run out trying to run for three.
What makes it almost more impressive is the context of the previous dropped catch, because I think we often see it in games like this that I know it gets overused in cricket commentary, but momentum goes against a team, and you have that drop catch, and however positive you want to feel, you look around and you just start to think, oh, it's not going to be our day.
It's like that, that drop the World Cup kind of moment.
Exactly. That was our chance and we dropped it. So the very next ball to come up with something like that suggests great composure, great focus, and I suppose great belief as well.
Exactly. So the teams are now tied. There's one wicket and two balls left. So the other piece of context that I haven't even mentioned is that there are only a certain number of overs that can be bowled in the day. So this is the last over. So Australia have to win it in this over. So one wicket, two balls left, the team's tied. So Klein's the new batsman. He nudges a full-length ball into the leg side and he hesitates. The video of this is on YouTube, actually, of the highlights of this. You see him hesitate for a moment, which I think holds up Mekif at the non-striker's end. Solomon picks up the ball at mid-wicket and he has one stump to throw at. And because of all of that practice with the mangoes, he doesn't falter and he throws down that one stump to leave the test a tie. Now there's a kind of another wonderful sub story here, which is that Klein was adamant that they had to run that ball even though there was one ball left and they only needed one run. He just wanted to get off. He thought, here's a chance, I've just got to take it, because who knows what's going to happen next ball, I'm a number 11. Mekif at the non-striker's end agreed to it, but he agreed to the run only because he actually thought there were two to win at that point. So he thought, well, we've just got to run one, get me back on strike, and then I can try and hit a single on the next ball. So Mekif leaves the pitch thinking that the West Indian celebrations are all because the West Indies have won the game, and it's only when he gets off the ground that he actually realizes that it's ended in a tie, not in a win. I talked about the kind of close bond between the teams that existed before the series. This result only brought them closer. They all realized immediately that they've been part of something pretty special. This was the first ever tie test. There's a rather wonderful story about immediately after the game that an impromptu dinner was prepared, and the West Indies and the Australian players alternated side by side around the table to swap stories about this game. The review, and for this episode we have been reading The Miracle Makers, Indian Cricket's Greatest Epic, published in 2023 by Bharat Sundaresan, who's the senior cricket writer for CricBuzz and a commentator for Sen Radio here in Australia. And he writes this book with Gaurav Joshi, who's a cricket writer and commentator who's worked for, among others, Fox Sports, Cricket Australia, and the ABC. Andy, tell us a bit about what this book covers.
So the book tells the story of India's improbable Test series victory in Australia back in 2020 and 2021. This was achieved despite a huge, almost ridiculous number of injuries and all the challenges of COVID restrictions. It is not a straightforward tour diary, which I think I might have expected when I picked this up. We jump around and we get background on the experience of covering the tour. We get the experience of background knowledge of the players and the coaches. And it jumps around a lot in that way. All, I think, in the aim of giving context to that tour.
How I was initially... I wasn't expecting it. I was expecting a blow-by-blow context, first test, second test, third test, fourth test, wrap-up kind of structure with a few digressions in there. And I suppose I was slightly thrown sometimes by the structure. And not being as rigid as that. But what I ended up loving this book, and I ended up loving it because it was like sitting down to dinner with a really well-informed friend and saying, tell me about this series from what you know on the inside. And through that, I learned, having followed that series and I went to the SCG test and followed the series really closely because it was an extraordinary series. But through this book, I learned an awful lot more about it. And I think part of that is because the format is discursive and allows Sundaresan to bring out whatever anecdotes he might have to hand. And certainly one thing that is really significant, therefore, is the level of access that he has to the Indian team.
It's almost extraordinary because you hear a lot of sports journalists now, particularly cricket journalists who've been on the circuit for a while, lament the fact that they don't have that access anymore. They look back to the 80s where you'd have a beer with Ian Botham at the end of play or whatever. And it's amazing. I didn't know journalists could have what Sundaresan has in terms of how well he knows the team. If you're being... There's a bit of a juggling act here because I wonder how easy Sundaresan would find it to be critical, because he doesn't hide his affection for the people involved. I think in the context of this series, it's a bit irrelevant because it was such a wonderful series and India did so wonderfully. But he writes with the enthusiasm of fans, certainly. And I really enjoyed getting that insider view because it made me realise that I just don't really know this India team. All these names were familiar to me, but I guess I so often read it through the prism of the English press that it was great to get that.
Who do you think is the target audience for this book?
Well, my not very complicated answer is I was guessing Indian fans. I would guess. I would guess because it feels like rightfully it's a tribute to that wonderful team and that wonderful achievement. And it's written as a fan, and I really want to be careful in how I'm saying this because it's not a criticism because, and I think we'll get into this more and more, the quality of the journalism, the detail of his digging is superb. But I also think you have to be honest and say on the one side, you know, this is not written as a hard-nosed account. This is written as someone who...
You know, Sundaresan writing about India is not the same as Gideon Haigh writing about Australia. It's a world of difference in terms of the relationship with the subject. But if you're... I mean, in a way, I actually found the it's certainly not hagiography, but there's very little negative commentary about the Indian individuals or the Indian team. But as soon as you get past that, exactly as you say, one of the things that's really impressive and thought-provoking is actually finding out about what was happening on the inside, behind the scenes, at key moments in this series. You know, I was really interested to read about what it was that Kohli was actually saying to his batsmen in the lead up to the series about how to play in Australia and what changes in technique they needed to make in order to play in Australia. And so often, I mean, where else are you going to get that kind of content from? And if it comes with the some of the kind of subjectivity that sits around that, then so be it.
One thing this book has completely converted me to is the merit of journalists watching training. And I've often seen on Twitter, journalists will post clips and they'll post photos. And I often think, well, you know, if you're on tour in Australia, India, England, whatever, and you've got nothing to do that day, well, you know, why not go and watch training? But I have to say, I think I naively always thought, you know, how much do you get out of watching these players have a net? The quality of journalism, this is where I think I referred to earlier, the willingness to dig and to really watch in detail, I think you get so many gems out of it. Coming back to your point, there's that, I was taken aback by how much technical work there is, because you often hear players say, look, you get to test level, you've kind of made it at that point. You're not going to be making big changes to your game. But actually, we've got Kohli working with his opening batsman, Mayank Agarwal in the nets, spotting a really particular issue with his back foot. Really kind of technical stuff. I love the colour as well. I have to refer to Kohli, what's the best way of putting it? Joshing Pujara when he was padding up to a spinner in the nets and repeatedly shouting, use your bat, you have such a big bat. It was also totally on trend to hear that Justin Langer screams warrior, warrior at
Smith replies and goes, no, I'm warrior. I did actually, when I was walking out to bat today, think, shall I think of myself as a warrior? And I couldn't quite take myself seriously enough to be able to do that.
And this is what holds you back from being Steve Smith. We should probably make a couple of comments on the series itself, because obviously that's the, I mean, I had totally forgotten, and you're probably a lot, you know, you lived it, you were there. I had forgotten the consequences of Australia's regional approach to COVID leads to some very interesting situations. So Sundaresan begins the first lines of the book, dashing to New South Wales to avoid a lockdown in South Australia, and manages it by 9 minutes. And it does give you, I have to say, it was a bit, I don't want to be transported back to COVID pandemic time. So that was almost a bit chastening. And I also, and you might, again, must remember this very well, but this controversy that when around 30,000 Australians were still abroad waiting to come, be allowed to come home, this Indian test team was allowed in.
Yeah, all that. And that in one state you could have 50,000, you know, rugby league fans gathered together to watch a game, and in another state people wouldn't be let out of their homes for more than half an hour a day in order to... All of this kind of weird cognitive dissonance. But it does... What's interesting is the impact that has on the Indian team when they fly into Australia and they suddenly have to do 14 days quarantine, and then they can't live the touring life that they ordinarily would... Woodley, you were talking earlier about the about watching training and what one can learn from watching training, but they also spend a lot of time watching the, you know, Indian team transferring between different hotels, and then also at the Blacktown Oval here in Sydney, the preparations they make kind of under those circumstances, and the way that, for instance, the fast bowlers kind of pace themselves from, you know, day one they want to bowl 4 overs at top speed, by the end of day 14 they want to bowl 10 overs, and the way that the whole coaching team had to have a mentality around how to prepare a team during COVID under these circumstances.
They also seem to have made it work. I mean, you obviously see that in the result, but in the morale in the camp. And I do wonder if, you know, hopefully this is something that other teams will never have to go through again, but there was a lot coming out of the England camp at a similar time that they were really struggling with the bubble. And I wonder whether some of the England coaches or players would read this and think, oh, that's interesting. You know, India found a way to keep spirits up that we maybe didn't. A little bit more on the cricket, perhaps. I was intrigued by Ravi Shastri and Bharat Aaron coming up with a sort of semi-bodyline-ish approach, you know, not maybe the same hostility.
Stop runs
that was
rather
interesting.
Than, you know, put the batsman in danger. Yeah, I hadn't realised, having watched a lot of that series, I hadn't realised that was a concerted, a kind of concerted approach until reading it here.
No, and I always loved the way it was come up with. There obviously was lots of analysis and stats underpinning it, but it also seemed a little bit like Ravi Shastri having a brainwave, which is fun as well as a way of planning these things. We can't obviously give the full story of the series again, but the story of Ashwin and Vihari's stand at the SCG, Vihari with torn a hamstring, Ashwin with bad back, Ashwin playing lion because he could move forward while Vihari left with the quicks. I know we do a lot of stories, and we've done a few on this podcast about players in pain. I mean, you were talking about Wes Hall, you know, minutes ago. This is still right up
yeah,
there.
Yeah, I'd actually forgotten kind of the extent to which it was kind of, it was a sort of bit of a dad's army team by the end of the series in terms of, you know, and Washington Sundar, who came on and really starred towards the end of the series, was only in the squad as a net bowler. Because he could imitate Nathan Lyon, and suddenly there he is, kind of thrust into the middle. The other big kind of turning point of the series is obviously India get absolutely thrashed in the first test in Adelaide, bowled out for 36 or whatever it was, and then Kohli goes home, and there's something like, well, how are they going to come back from that without Kohli? And I love the fact that Shastri apparently in the dressing room just looked around at everyone and just said, shit happens. And that was the kind of analysis of it. Right, let's move on. Again, those kind of insider insights are the thing that really kind of distinguish this book for me. I also really enjoy the way that it is written, the tone of the writing as well. It's a very, very readable account and a good length. So overall, I would say I thoroughly enjoyed this book and would absolutely recommend it. The other thing that I would say is that often reviews of series that come out quite soon after don't benefit from that proximity to the cricket, whereas I think this one really does benefit from proximity both in terms of the time and in terms of the level of access that the writers have to the players and the coaches in question.
And that was the 173rd episode of Reverse Swept Radio. Thanks very much for joining us. You can find us at Reverse Swept at Twitter. We always appreciate a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. And we look forward to joining you next time.